So, Catherine, thanks for speaking with me. I'd love to know more about your story, which you have shared in bits and pieces on your website, about your start in radio and then the transition to what you're doing now and how that came about. Can you share some of that backstory with me?
Like a lot of young people, I was confused about what I thought I wanted to do when I grew up. Maybe you can relate. I was a nursing major at Valparaiso University. And a guy in my dormitory said to me one night, you know, you should be on the radio. You have a great voice. I was stunned. I've never heard anything so ridiculous. The whole idea of me on the radio. However, I had a crush on this guy. So when he proposed that we go and audition for shows on the campus radio station, I was all over that idea. Sadly, I got a show. Well, happily, I got a show. Sadly, he did not, which was kind of the end of a budding relationship. Although the truth is, he turned out to be gay. I didn't know. I don't think he knew. But there was never going to be a romance developing here. Anyway, that's how I started in radio, completely by accident. And it turned out to be so much fun and so interesting. And when the faculty of the College of Nursing suggested that perhaps I should make myself available for some other opportunity, I decided this radio stuff was cool. I think I'll do that. And I had no idea how challenging it would be. This was early 70s. And when I went to register for broadcasting classes at a new school, starting all over, the head of the department told me he really didn't believe there was a place for gals in broadcasting.
Oh, geez.
Can you imagine people would actually say that to your face?
Yeah. Wow.
He was wrong. And although I will say there are still today limits for women in broadcasting, there's a reason they refer to morning men, because mostly they are. But yeah, I had a great career. I was in radio for 25 years, and then it caved in and I had to start fresh. And here I am.
Yeah. So that is what I love about this was, you know, clearly you had found a sweet spot purely by accident or by, you know, serendipity. And then you had to reinvent and say, well, what, you know, you take what you are very good at, right, which is speaking on the radio. And now you are coaching people on public speaking. So my question for you there, well, there's a few of them, but there's quite a difference between speaking in a microphone and you can't see what I'm doing with my hands or where I'm looking or how I'm standing, to putting yourself physically in front of people on a stage. So that has to have been a change, a transition for you. How did that learning curve go? How did that process go for you?
It was, you're exactly right. It was challenging. When I set out to investigate speaking as a career, I was telling somebody at a National Speakers Association meeting, you know, what I like is small groups and it's interactive and they're talking back and it's not just me on a big stage. They said, oh, you want to be a trainer? I didn't know about training. I'd been living in this broadcasting bubble all these years. We had training one time when WLS got a voicemail system, when voicemail was new, they brought in a trainer from the phone company. So I had a lot to learn, and it turned out it was a good fit. Training was right for me. Challenging to find a job at that point as a communication trainer, because people who hired those folks preferred to hire somebody who'd done it before.
Sure.
And making a switch is not so easy. I was lucky to find a company that was looking for, and this was a real key for me, they had me come in and do an audition, really. You know, get in front of 12 consultants and tell them why they should hire me. A sales presentation, which I had never done in my life, telling me.
Yeah.
That was challenging.
No
and
kidding.
And their feedback when I was finished was, needs work on presentation skills. What the hell is her problem with eye contact?
Yeah.
25 years in radio, baby. There's no eye contact there. And I didn't know I had a problem. And I find that, Anne, with most of my clients today, they will tell me in a heartbeat, oh, eye contact's fine. I don't have any problems with that. Then they get in front of a room full of people and stare over their heads or at the floor, or they dart around the room because everybody knows you're supposed to make eye contact, so they try to look at everybody at once. It is a huge skill for a person who presents in person, and one of the main things that I insist on my clients mastering, because it is key to in-person communication. And for that matter, it makes a difference virtually too, but that's a story for another time. Anyway, these people hired me in spite of my clear lack of skills, because they were confident that they could teach me those skills. That's what they did for a living. And what they were looking for, and this is really an important thing maybe for some people listening, what they wanted was somebody who could command a room. They could teach me how to use the flip chart and markers. They could teach me what to do with my hands when I'm teaching. But it's hard to teach command of the room.
Sure.
People have a natural energy or not, and they wanted that. So that's how I got into communication consulting and training.
That's a great story.
Yeah, by being bossy and commanding a room. Isn't it great?
Well, it's playing to your strengths, right? I guess that's what it's about.
You know, in all honesty, what I teach my clients is, yes, command of the room and connection with the audience. And
right.
It's really a balance. It's a dance between them. The masterful speakers and the really good leaders have both of those qualities and can move seamlessly so that command comes out, or they soften and emphasize connection. Most of us are better at one than the other, and so we have to learn the part that is not as natural for us.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I love the focus on connection. I think that's probably my strength compared to command.
Yeah, it probably is. And for me, it's the opposite. And in as I work with different clients, what I see is that in general, and there certainly are exceptions, women are better at connection, and mm-hmm. men have an edge when it comes to command.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people who are really good communicators develop the one that is not their natural strength. For me, command comes pretty naturally. I work at connection. I do very intentional things with an audience to connect with every individual in a room.
Right.
And that's what I teach.
The truth is you need both. I mean,
absolutely.
One without the other is not going to fly, right?
No, because either you come across as sort of a blunderbuss, you know, you're throwing your weight around, or you're a bully, or you're too strong, or you're intimidating, or you could be a doormat, you know, and people feel like, boy, she's really nice, but I'm not totally sure she's an expert on this subject. So really, we need elements of both, and the skill comes in weaving them together, or as I said, dancing between them, so that our audiences benefit both from our ability to command a room and from our ability to connect with them.
So I'm just going to dig in a moment on command a room, because you just made an explicit connection between commanding the room and inhabiting authority, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the command of the room is your authority, not just over the speaking space, but the topic, that you are a person who is worth listening to.
Yeah.
Right. That seems to be certainly a barrier, a difficulty for a lot of people, a discomfort for, and I, maybe I'm saying for more women than men, but not exclusively, clearly.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fair.
Yeah. So how do you get people, because before you can communicate it, you must internalize it, right?
Yes, and I think the easiest way to do that is to work from the outside in. So I could tell myself all day, I'm in charge of this room, or I'm confident, or I'm an expert on this subject. And maybe eventually I would believe it, and then maybe somebody else would believe it. Or I could really ground myself, and you can do it with me right now. Ground yourself so your feet are flat on the floor, both of them. So we're not sitting with our ankles crossed or one leg up underneath us, but 2 feet flat on the floor, pushing slightly down into the floor, and sit bones grounded on the chair. And then from that, sort of turn on the leg muscles a little bit so they're activated. The way you would do if you've ever done yoga, mountain pose. Think mountain pose. you're really rooted here. And then stack your spine up and let your shoulders drop down and back, and make sure your head is straight up and down on top of your body, and your chest is open, so you're very expansive. And even you might put your arms out, rest them on the desk or the table, whatever's close, arm of the chair, but you're aiming to take up space. And this is one way we command a room. We get ourselves in this posture that says, I belong here. I have no doubt. I'm not perched. I'm not slinking around. I'm not hiding. I'm not folded in on myself. This is my space, and I'm an expert.
Isn't it interesting how that physical presence has such a visceral reaction within ourselves as well as those around us?
Totally.
It is just fascinating. Yeah.
It makes all the difference in the world. And so some of the work I do with clients is changing what might be their natural habits that they've developed over time. I have a picture of my confirmation class from the Glenview United Methodist Church in, I don't know, sometime in the 60s. All the girls in the front row sitting with their ankles crossed and their hands folded in their laps.
Yep. Yep, as we were taught to take up little space, you know, make yourself small. That. Yes, yeah.
And so those habits die hard. I actually think women who are a generation or two behind us, behind me, I have an advantage because Title IX.
Yeah, that's true.
They were active in sports as girls or young women and learned to be strong, to take up space, to defend their territory. And that is a huge advantage. And those of us who are older, most of us didn't play sports in the same way, missed out on that. So some of this is just body stuff.
Just body.
And then, Sorry, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's great. That's just, it's simply body intelligence. I mean, it's stuff that we can be taught. I mean, I've read Amy Cuddy's excellent book, Presence. And experimented with some of those things myself, and just have been amazed by the reaction. I was once at a conference at a round table. You know, and the problem with a round table is that conversations can kind of all, you can sit there and the person on your right is talking to the person on their right, and the person on your left is, you know, and in this case, the person on my left was a man who was hitting on the younger woman, you know, on his left. So it's like, well, I stay out of that. But I just decided, well, I just read Presence. So I just leaned back and I draped one arm over the back of my chair and that sort of taking up more space and being comfortable in the situation. And he immediately turned to me, stopped hitting on the woman next to him, and just started asking me a question about my content area.
Isn't that fascinating?
It was fascinating. So I would encourage anyone to try this. Now, let me ask you another question, because I am a singer, and we're talking about voice. And writing voice is one thing, but speaking voice is another. And I've noticed generationally there are certain speaking patterns that can put us at a...
I never noticed that?
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Upspeak. I found myself on a podcast with a young woman who was doing a lot of upspeak, which is right, what you're just demonstrating. And the other funny thing is that I discovered myself using the same speech patterns. So, we speak like those around us as well as... Sure. Those we're speaking to. So I think we need to be very confident or thinking about our vocal patterns. So upspeak is one, clearly making firm sentences that end, not being afraid to leave a pause, right? These are all things that you preach, I'm sure. Right?
Well, yes. And a couple of things I would add. The upspeak thing started out with young women, but has spread like wildfire. And I hear men do it too, younger men primarily.
Yes.
But I hear that same thing. In American English, and other languages are very different, but in American English, we assume from tone a meaning for words. And when the words sound like a question, we assume questioning, whether you mean it that way or not.
Yeah.
And that comes across as not being certain of what you're saying or begging for agreement or you're trying it out. And it really undermines credibility.
Yeah.
In terms of voice, it, as a singer, you know all about diaphragmatic breathing.
Mm-hmm.
For many of my clients and people who come to my workshops, it's a new notion of breathing all the way down so that the diaphragm moves. So I think of it as breathing, speaking from your core is the language I use. And to do that, you need to breathe so that you use your full lung capacity. And you can imagine breathing all the way down into your lower belly, although lungs don't actually go down that far if we were looking at the anatomy.
Right.
You want that whole part of your body to expand, not just the front, but your side body and your back body, so that your lungs are really full. And the energy comes from the core, maybe even from the earth, going back to our feet are grounded on the floor and we're firmly rooted. The energy comes up and out. My experience working with women is that many of them get stuck in their head. There's a block in their throat chakra. I'm not getting woo-woo, but stay with me on this. So their energy is blocked and they start talking like this. So the voice is produced from the head and it sounds kind of thin and tinny and a little bit nasal because I'm not using all of that resonance possibility in my diaphragm. When I work with men, they're more likely, some are stuck in their head, but more likely it's the throat. So they get kind of a raspy sound and they're forcing from their throat instead of supporting their voice with the energy from the rest of their body.
Yeah. Yeah.
The throat chakra, I'm not a chakra expert by any means, but it's associated with communication.
Yeah.
And when the energy is blocked there, it's as if our communication is choked off and we sound less resonant, less rich.
Right.
And we have less impact.
Right. Yeah. I think I don't want to say that I try to pitch my voice lower because that's not true, but I do try to work in the lower parts of my register when I speak on a recording or speaking out loud, because that will, it just opens, you know, I will open up. And as a singer, I actually have control over my soft palate, right? So I can think about making sure I'm not being nasal by just doing something with my soft palate without going, you know, Julia Childs, which is really easy to do. You don't want to go there.
No, you don't.
Don't.
One of the things I suggest for clients is not to force the voice lower, because you're right, we have a natural pitch, each of us, or a range that feels right for us, and I don't think it's useful to try to force my voice to be something else. I do think that I want to speak more of the time in the lower register of my natural range.
Yes.
And then use the higher notes for emphasis. So my voice comes up into my head to make a point or to make something stand apart. But I am primarily speaking from the lower part of my natural range.
Right. You're living in that lower register, which is not forcing it. I'm not, you know, not going there. Right. That's great. That's great. Great advice.
It is really, in a way, rooted in sexism, because the research on this is very clear. People associate credibility with a lower voice.
Mm.
For years, there were only men doing the news or commercials on television.
Yeah.
You know, you go back far enough, and if it wasn't a feminine hygiene product they were talking about, it was a male voice doing the talking, because men were perceived as having the credibility because men ran the place. And so some of this is just lingering perceptions from that era that people still ascribe more credibility and more authority to a lower voice.
Right. And as long as that's the case, we need to piggyback on it, unfortunately. I mean, it shouldn't be, but that's how things are. I've had people tell me they would never buy an audiobook that was narrated by a woman.
Like, really? Oh,
still? Thank you. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, a business person telling me about that. I've narrated all my own audiobooks. It's like, okay, well, so sorry, I'm not going to hire a man to speak in my voice. So.
Well, no. I mean, I did an audiobook too, and I don't think anybody could read it as well as I did, because it's my figurative voice and my literal voice.
Yes. Yeah. 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 So we should not be afraid. You know, we should not try to be like men, if as women, but we should not be afraid to show up as women, but we should, if we want to reach as large an audience as possible, we do need to make our voices as authoritative as they can be. And that means not buying into those, not doing the hesitancy conversational things like I just did, and asking a lot of questions, do you think?
It also means, you mentioned pausing earlier, and you know, when I do presentation skills work, I always say eye contact is the most powerful tool you have to establish both connection with the audience and command of the room. And the next most powerful one is the pause. Ah. You can stand in front of an audience and have nothing coming out of your mouth for even a moment, you own the room.
Yeah.
And many people are very, very nervous about pausing. And that's why they like, you know, so kind of K, basically, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you need to, you earn the ability to pause, and then pausing earns you the respect, you know, so it's a virtuous cycle somehow in there.
People get nervous that if they pause, they'll lose their audience. People will lose interest. They'll stop listening. They'll tune out. It's the opposite. I mean, I've watched this many times. I pause and I see people literally lean in. Mm-hmm. I see their eyes on me. I feel the energy of them waiting for what's coming.
Yeah.
You're not going away.
Yeah.
If you're doing your job well, that pause pulls them in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I would encourage everyone to be courageous and try a pause. When you're speaking. This is great. Thank you for your wonderful advice. And let me ask you one more question.
Sure.
About this. So you right now coach people on their public speaking. What motivates you in this work? What's your driving motivation, the thing pulling you out of bed doing this?
I just love it. I don't know if, I mean, I know that's not very profound, but I particularly enjoy working with women, although I certainly have male clients too. And it's about all the things we're talking about. I think the world is full of women who haven't fully shown up. And so we're missing out on their brilliance.
That's great.
And so helping people find a way to release that so that they're strength and their smarts and their personality is made manifest when they speak. That's big work.
That is big work, and that's important work. I love the way you put it. People who haven't fully shown up. That's brilliant. Wonderful. It's wonderful work you're doing. I am a big fan, obviously, of your work and your philosophy, and I love watching your videos and I'm inspired by them. Yeah. So it's helpful when I don't get to hide behind a podcast or something, when I have to be in video, I will just channel my inner Catherine.
There you go. It'll stand you in good stead.
It will indeed. It will indeed. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me about this.
My pleasure, Anne.